San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you from KFMB Studios with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, L.A. County, Riverside County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night out to the desert. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He's a CPA extraordinaire. He's a marathon runner. He's a family office expert advising many high net worth clients. And he's a core member of Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you?
I'm tired, Joe. I just got done running my third half marathon in 15 days.
Oh, my gosh. This guy, he lost 11 pounds in Boston on the last April, and he's just been bouncing back.
So I did. Well, you know, I'm trying to get back into it after my eye surgery, and I thought the only way to get back into long distance running is to go do some long distance running.
Obviously.
So, you know, if you pay your entry fees of $50, it motivates you to go out and get your money's worth.
And the eyes are doing well, right?
Yeah, everything's good.
Excellent.
Everything's good.
Well, I've got some really great news. We had, I believe in January, we had George Takei from Star Trek and Star of Allegiance, which is his life legacy work, and two producers, Lorenzo Tione and Wendy Gillespie. So last Monday night at the Sherwood Auditorium up there at the Museum of Contemporary Art in La Jolla was the annual San Diego Theater Critics Circle Awards, and Allegiance won the Best New Musical of the Year, which they were just ecstatic about. So
that's great news, and I guess they're well on their way to getting on Broadway, but we don't want to jinx it. So we're not going to say that they're on Broadway.
It's not official yet, but from my discussions with everybody, it sounds like they are way ahead of their fundraising goals, and things are looking very optimistic. So speaking of Broadway, our guest tonight is we imported from Broadway in New York, and I'll let you do the honors.
We have with us, from one of our great sponsors, UBS, Stephen Friedman. And Stephen speaks many languages. We were thinking about doing one quarter of the show in English, one quarter in German, one in Spanish, and one in French, but we're not going to because I don't think all of our listeners speak as many languages as Stephen, but we're really happy to have Stephen here in studio.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been with UBS for quite some time, and of course, is a member of their Wealth Management America's Investment Committee.
And he's a PhD and a CFA, and born and raised in Switzerland, right, Stephen?
So Stephen, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
And we'd love to start a little bit with your background. I know you're from Switzerland. How did you come to this business that you're in? How did you come to UBS? What is it that you love about doing what you do?
Well, I was born in Switzerland in an American family. I went through all of the school system over there. I studied economics, and it turned out that I really liked economics. I liked analyzing the economy, financial markets.
And what city in Switzerland were you born and raised?
I was born in Geneva.
Geneva, okay.
Then I had to move to the German part of the country to study, and started working in Zurich.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that if you're an economist and you want to get a job as an economist in Switzerland, you probably are going to end up at a bank. So I started working for UBS, and I always thought I was an economist working at a bank. Eventually, things evolve, and you get sort of absorbed by the system.
Mm-hmm.
But I always made sure that I was doing things that had research involved or analysis, trying to solve problems, trying to help people understand what was going on. And I worked for UBS in Zurich for a number of years. And then back in 2007, I switched locations within the firm, moving to New York. My timing was perfect. It was about a week before the subprime concept became a household name.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest is history.
So what do you think about politics in this country, having been here only 6 years, and the recent fiscal cliff? And I'll also ask the question in the context of, was the fiscal cliff's effects on the market what you expected, or was it something otherwise?
Well, what I think of politics, I feel like I'm forced to spend way too much time worrying about politics in order to understand what's happening in the economy and the markets. I'd like to be able to focus on the economics more. And that's just a fact of life. It just is the case that policymakers have a lot of leverage in terms of what happens. And you need to try to figure out what the outcomes of all these negotiations, these bargains are. Regarding the fiscal cliff, you know, ultimately, this was one of these concepts. We call these tail risks, you know, these low probability, very bad scenarios. And the fiscal cliff happening was one of those. Mm-hmm. And just because the potential for a recession was very real, if the entire set of measures had expired, markets were worried about that. You know, I think ultimately what happened was what's most expected, that ultimately a last-minute deal, and indeed it was so last-minute they actually, you know, needed one extra day to do this. That's ultimately what panned out. So right now, you know, the market has one of these weights that's been lifted off of it. But at the same time, the fiscal cliff has been traded for a series of mini cliffs. So now it's not one big...
I think that's what the problem with a lot of investors and consumers have. What is a real crisis and what is a real fiscal cliff? I mean, what's political and what's reality? And because we've been to these fiscal cliffs before, right, Richard?
I mean, well, we have. I guess my next question, though, is that we're not all the way through the fiscal cliff in the context of we still have the budget issue coming up. In about a month. And is that going to be another down to the wire? Absolutely insane. Everybody worried about whether or not government employees are going to get paid circumstance? Or do you think any lessons were learned by our last exercise over the holiday?
I think it may very well go down to the wire. And, you know, I think it's not unlikely that you may get a temporary shutdown of the government. You know, it could be a couple of days, but it may take just that extra pressure for something to get done. I mean, it really seems everything we hear is that the mood in Washington, D.C. is really as bad as it's ever been. It's worse, according to our sources, than it was in 2011 when the debt ceiling was first dealt with.
Wow,
so,
that's
so
scary.
It's hard to really see a path for an agreement right now.
That's why I'm glad that movie Lincoln just came out, because it was pretty bad back then, too. So
that's a good reminder.
So, Joe, you're saying it's okay that it's bad now because it was bad back then?
Well, I think, you know, it's a different kind of battle now.
Yeah.
I think back then, obviously, it was more human rights, and now it's it looks like fiscal or financial interests clashing. So
any worries in the stock market or the bond market about the impending budget deadline? Or was the income tax fiscal cliff much more problematic in that regard?
I think that that's exactly right. I think what we got solved at the beginning of the year was a much more significant risk. Now this is going to be something, you know, it could create some market setbacks, but it's really going to be just a source of annoyance. It's going to be a source of noise, you know, a lot of headlines. But I think in terms of its potential impact, it's less severe than what we just got over.
Interesting. And let me ask you a question as a native European, because my friends, I have a lot of friends still in Switzerland since my family is originated from there, as well as other parts of Europe. They sort of laugh at us because of our political system. I mean, forget about your role in UBS. I mean, honestly, what do you think about this as somebody who's fairly new to this country as a resident 6 years in?
Well, you know, Europe is a big place. There are many different political systems, and some of them are very dysfunctional as well. So, you know, I think it's not a black or white thing. I would say what really has struck me the most in these years, and I think it's become worse really over the past 2 or 3 years, is just the unwillingness to get a compromise. It really seems like that there's no common grounds, that, you know, there's so much polarization in Congress. That's really one of the key problems we're having. You know, it's not that we don't have solutions. We would have a solution to fix the longer term debt problems. You know, Simpson-Bowles Commission came up with a plan that most economists thought was pretty decent.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just no way to get both sides of the aisle to agree to that.
The Volcker Rule has some, you know, a lot of people are interested in that, but, you know, who knows?
Well, here's what's interesting to me. Okay, so the fiscal cliff, we have this new tax legislation, the American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012, and I've got to present on this on Tuesday night, February 19th, at the San Diego Estate Planning Council. And so I'm going through all the materials, getting ready for my presentation. My presentation isn't so much about just, you know, this tax rate went from 15 to 20 and this one went from 35 to 39.6. I'm talking about what it means to people who own businesses and are high net worth and real estate investors, you know, what it means to real life taxpayers and businesses. But I'm going through all of the expiration dates of all of the stuff that was extended. And the most common expiration date of all of the new provisions is actually December 31st, 2013. The majority of things that are in that bill are only good for 1 year. Now, I'm not going to sit here and list everything and what the effect. Some stuff is 17, some stuff is permanent. But the point is, there's more stuff that expires in a year than there's stuff that goes beyond a year. So When you talk about permanence in the income tax code, I guess now that's defined as 12 months or less. Yeah. It's bizarre.
Yeah. Anyway, Richard, I think we're coming up on our first break right now, though. So we'll be right back with more from Stephen Freeman, Richard Musi, and myself after this. Stay tuned.
Now, it's your money and your life on Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
All right, we're back with Richard Musio, Stephen Friedman from UBS, and myself. I guess we wanted to get into the Swiss political system real quickly, right, Richard?
We were just curious. Just compare and contrast how the political system works in Switzerland compared to our rather interesting processes in this
our
country.
Our challenges.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the Swiss system has its problems as well, but there's one feature when we're talking about polarization and the inability to find a compromise. The Swiss system is very much based on compromise. So the way it works is you have seven ministers, that's basically the cabinet, and they're chosen in a way that they represent the four main parties in the country.
Four parties.
And then
okay.
There's not really a head of state. The seven ministers together are the government.
There's no president or premier or anything?
There's a president, but he's basically there to cut ribbons.
Okay.
Really a powerful position.
Okay. Interesting.
Well, we have a lot to learn. But anyway, be that as it may. So let's talk a little bit about what you do. You sent over a fascinating report. So your basic function is to basically do due diligence and research to sort of put forth what might be described as a roadmap or a path for what you think the upcoming year might bring in terms of investment opportunities and challenges. Am I summarizing that right?
Yeah, basically what I do is investment strategy. So we're basically providing guidance on which asset classes, which regions and sectors within asset classes investors should focus on, taking sort of a 6 month to a year ahead view of the world. So it's based on understanding the economics, on understanding the, you know, the earnings picture, and then just looking at where the opportunities are and where the risks are.
So can I just throw out some general classes and we can maybe discuss them? Would that work?
Sure.
Starting with, Europe. Let's even extend that. Europe, China. I know about a year ago we were talking about how the economic outlook there was fairly bleak. Is this getting better? Is it getting worse? What are you seeing?
Well, in Europe, and here we're talking about the Eurozone or the Monetary Union specifically, we're expecting this year to be better, but it's still a pretty lousy situation. So basically, they're going to move out of recession, in our view, and basically have a flat growth. It's an improvement, but it's not the case that it really feels like a great business environment.
And is China accelerating at all? Because I know they had a bit of a slowdown.
Yeah, they had a slowdown last year. There were a lot of concerns of a hard landing there. I think we now have plenty of evidence that we saw the weakest point last year and that the economy is reaccelerating. I think what you got to think about in China is, though, that in the longer term, you know, they're going to be growing slower than they have over the last 15 years just because the economy is maturing and because wages are increasing. It's a much larger economy that's growing a bit slower. It's still going to be a very important engine of growth globally going forward.
And how about some more developed but smaller countries like New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and the like? What are the outlooks there?
Yeah, those are countries that tend to be driven by the commodity cycle. I think that's something that's been very positive for them. I would say that it remains a positive, but we're less convinced that commodities are going to see a super cycle like they have over the past decade. So I think, those are countries that are interesting to look at, maybe as a diversifier, just because they'll react to other things than the U.S.
And I know we can't talk investment specifics, but in terms of, say, a typical portfolio at UBS, are you seeing investments in or allocations to foreign assets that are both ownership position stocks as well as lending positions bonds, or is it just one or the other?
I think generally speaking, international investments tend to focus a bit more on the stock market. And one of the issues is simply that if you're buying international bonds, typically it's a much more volatile investment than domestic bonds because you're getting the currency fluctuations. Mm-hmm. But I think there is a bit of a trend towards more international investment. We've actually changed a bit the portfolio allocations that we recommend to clients. And there we're essentially reducing the home bias, reducing the portion of the portfolio that is allocated to U.S. assets and diversifying more internationally.
Interesting. Yeah, because I think that probably is the wave of the future. Just I do a lot of reading, and I think there are a lot of people saying that.
Well, that's what puzzles me about the Dow Jones. I mean, it's hovering at 14,000, and yet our economy doesn't seem to be, we're not in full recovery mode right now. So Is that an indication of how global the financial markets have become now? Because is that a lot of foreign investment in the New York Stock Exchange?
Well, it's certainly the case that if you look at the companies that are in these big stock indices, they have a lot of activities abroad. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the S&P 500 has about 30% of its revenues coming from abroad. So, you know, they're benefiting from the growth abroad, even in cases when the U.S. is not doing that great.
Mm-hmm. But the investor funds are the source, you know, that comes a lot from Asia, Europe, as well as, you know, the States, but only 50% of the families have stock. Richard, is that even lower now?
It's probably lower now, mm-hmm. but... It, obviously, it's a more global economy, and more U.S. companies are doing business globally. So.
Which is why investors would need a UBS, because obviously you can advise and counsel investors as to what
on a global basis.
Right. Yeah. So that's, you know, we can't get that expertise at a local bank.
So can we talk about U.S. bonds? I know yield is still a challenge here in this country. Am I right?
Well, you know, we are at pretty close to historical lows.
I guess my question is, how low could we go?
Look, we think that the trend for bond yield is up.
Okay.
You know, it's going to be difficult to time exactly the moment when there's a big correction. But if you take a 5-year view of the world, in the next 5 years, monetary policy is going to start normalizing. You know, short-term interest rates are going to start rising, and bond yields are going to correct. We don't really see any drastic thing happening over the next year. We think it's going to be a progressive grind higher. But we will have some years that will post, you know, some pretty bad returns for bondholders.
And are corporate bonds attractive? I mean, I would think they are. When you look at how liquid so many major corporations are, I mean, their financial condition is maybe better than it's ever been because of all of the restructuring and the learning and retooling that they did, you know, given the crash of 4 and 5 years ago. Are corporate bonds still potentially an attractive market to maybe get some yield?
Now, we're absolutely favoring corporate bonds over government bonds. And this is partly because... as you say, you have very good fundamentals. The balance sheets are very solid. They're flush with cash, and there's not a very high risk of defaults spiking in this situation. But what's more important is really there's value in them. Basically, the additional yield you're getting for these bonds is overcompensating you for the risks. So, you know, in a situation where treasuries are going to be under pressure over a number of years, we do think that it's important to shift bond portfolios towards more corporate exposure.
Yeah, I think that trend might even continue to the extent that we get more income tax permanency or more budget permanency. I think some of the money, this is just my personal opinion, I think some of the money that's sitting on the sidelines might start getting deployed up until, well, the fiscal cliff settlement. It was hard for businesses to sort of present value the benefits of incurring costs like hiring more employees or investing in more capital equipment because we weren't necessarily sure how to tax affect that. Even though we could generally agree how to tax affect it, we couldn't be precise. So I think that might be a continuing trend now that we're at least somewhat more permanent with our income tax code. Would you agree or disagree?
Well, I do think that having elements in the tax code be a bit more, you know, clear for the years ahead, generally speaking, helps decision making. And it helps you know, all kinds of decisions on the financing side, on the hiring side, on the spending side.
So speaking about the domestic market, you were mentioning sectors. Are there sectors that you would sort of favor now or that appear to be stronger? And we'll ask the flip question after you answer the first one. If we were looking at sectors, what might be interesting to you right now?
Well, right now, in terms of U.S. stocks and the sectors we prefer, it's really the sectors that are globally oriented and cyclical. So it's basically technology, it's industrials and materials. And partly it's, you know, we have a relatively constructive view on the market, so typically cyclical sectors tend to do better. But you have sectors like technology that have actually had a hard time, and we think at this point they're just very cheap. Mm-hmm. We don't think, you know, they're trading as if the growth in technology was going to vanish, and we think that's not the case, and therefore there's an opportunity there. In terms of sectors that we don't like as much, it's really the flip side. It's the more defensive ones, in particular sectors that have... that just have a high dividend yield. There's been a lot of focus on just looking for high dividend yields, and sectors such as utilities and telecoms have gotten pretty expensive. We think there are probably better ways to get some income in stocks by looking at stocks that grow their dividends over time rather than those that are just paying out a lot.
Mm-hmm. How about energy? Any opinion on that?
Yeah, that's a sector that, you know, it's kind of in the middle of the pack. It's going to do okay. You're going to have some pockets that will benefit from things like, you know, this... this greater energy independence in North America, and greater production. These were probably more in the oil field services area. But, you know, at the same time, you're going to get more volume, more supply, and that's going to put some pressure on prices. So it's not going to be good for all energy companies indiscriminately.
And how about the flip side to my comment about liquidity, the great deleveraging? How far through are we in terms of our great deleveraging? Are we almost getting to the finish line, or do we have a long ways to go?
Well, that's a very good question. It's actually something I try to mention in every client meeting. We think we're about halfway in terms of the number of years. There's probably another 5 years to go.
Wow, okay.
But I think what's important to realize is that typically the front end of a deleveraging process is the more painful one. So the beginning of the deleveraging here was, you know, the consumer and the financial sector. They deleverage very quickly and they cause a recession. Right now, it's a much more progressive pace. So we think ultimately this deleveraging does reduce growth for a couple of years, but ultimately, once you're past that bulk of deleveraging, we can resume growing a bit faster.
And is Europe behind us on the deleveraging initiative, or are they sort of with us?
It depends. The governments are ahead of us. They've probably had the greatest fiscal drag last year, whereas for us it's probably going to be this year. But their banks haven't deleveraged, whereas in the U.S. after the financial crisis, banks were capitalized. The European banks did not seize that opportunity, and that's one of the problems that's leading to all these flare-ups and financial panics in Europe.
Okay, gentlemen, we have to take our long break right now, so let's come back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life after these announcements.
Now, It's Your Money and Your Life on Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
All right, we're back with the second half of It's Your Money and Your Life, and now over to Richard to thank some sponsors.
I want to thank all of our sponsors. Of course, at the top of the list is UBS, our major sponsor, UBS. And also in studio with us today, tonight, is Michael Quaranta from UBS. Also, his partner, Drew Freitas, is not with us, but he's still Michael's partner in the business. And they do a great job of supporting us and getting us all kinds of great information to help people manage their lives and their wealth. Other sponsors include and are limited to, usually we say are not limited to, but we have six others. Sean Puckett with Regions Bank, the best business bank here in San Diego. Rich Gaines and Family Legacy Legal, the best estate planning firm in town. Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives. If you are a real estate owner and you're trying to improve your cash flow, Joel can really do some amazing things for you. Our new daddy, father of Quinn, Jason Kruger, not getting much sleep at night with Signature Analytics, the best CFO and outsourced accounting company that I've ever met. Great business model. Carl Sheeler, who I just saw the other day for breakfast, the best business valuation expert that I've ever worked with in my 30 years of business. Again, Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited. And our favorite CPAs on the planet, Paul Polito and Don Epic, CPAs with Polito Epic Associates up in Vista. Again, those are our sponsors, and those are the entire list of our sponsors. And to find out more about our sponsors, Joe, people can go where?
You can go to iymoney.com, click on the sponsors tab, and all their information is right there. Contact, phone numbers, emails, bios, everything that you'd need. And, of course, we have Michael Quaranta, Vice President of UBS here. Would you like to give your information out?
Yeah, Mike, shout out how people can get a hold of you, because we're going to mention an investment strategy guide, and some of our listeners might want to get that. So how can they contact you?
You can contact me at Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, Quaranta, at UBS.com, or you can reach me direct by phone at 858-551-9422. But I just want to share that Stephen provides some very thoughtful work monthly through our investment strategy guide, and the title to the February monthly is Fundamentals Finally Wagging the Dog. So we'd be very happy to provide that to you and let you review that at your convenience.
Yeah, it's a great guide. I've actually read through it twice because 30, there's so much in there.
35-page report there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Hey, gentlemen, I also noticed, keeping up on the news, UBS is the first bank to actually meet the what are known as the Basel III standards, which is sort of a funny term, but that's a big deal. Can you explain what the Basel III standards are and why this is important?
Sure. You know, there's this Basel Committee on Banking Supervision that is based in Basel, Switzerland. We're basically the global regulators, starting 20 years ago, started coming up with international standards for how well capitalized banks should be. So this is really kind of a global minimum standard. And you know, as the name suggests, there's been a Basel II, which was a bit of an upgrade to that, and now we're in the process of starting with Basel III. And every time, you know, it gets a bit more complex. We're not going to go into the details, but ultimately, it's about ensuring that banks have an adequate buffer of capital to absorb losses in case they happen.
Hmm. Yeah, we're seeing lots of fun things happening in the banking world in this country because of Dodd-Frank, especially as it relates to the smaller and more regional banks. But that's a radio show in and of itself for another time. So we were talking about bonds before the break, and we were talking about this term called bond vigilantes, where bondholders sort of punish governments by exiting bonds when they're not happy with what governments are doing. Do you think we have any susceptibility for seeing that again? I think the last time we sort of saw this phenomenon was almost 20 years ago. It might have been around 1994. Any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, ultimately, the bond vigilantes are just the mechanism that ultimately leads to higher yields. And we think you will see that over the next 5 years. And this could happen because things are going well, because the economy is normalizing, growing faster, and the Fed starts to consider its exit strategy. That's something which very likely would lead the bond vigilantes to come in and, you know, start exiting the market. But it could also happen, and this is the less appealing scenario, if at some point the bond market loses faith in the U.S.'s ability to tackle its deficits. And at that point, it's more of a phenomenon a bit like you had in Europe, where yields rise not because things are improving, but just because there's risk involved in holding the bonds.
Yeah, yields rise when risk goes up, because people insist on being compensated for taking more risk, and that could happen. So on this report that we referenced, I know our listeners can't look at it unless they email Mike and get a copy, and I would suggest doing that because it's a great report. On page 11, the report that you wrote with Mike Ryan, who's also been a guest on the show, it was the heading is Market Scenarios Over the Next 12 Months, and I just want to read just some probabilities or some, I should say, circumstances and the probabilities of them. So you've assigned, for example, a 70% probability to this thing described as follows: sluggish expansion, which you call your base case scenario. What are you talking about here?
Yeah, maybe just a background. After the financial crisis, you know, so many people were wrong about their forecasts. So we started always talking about our base case, the most likely outcome, but also monitoring risk cases and really updating the probabilities. We find it a useful exercise to do. So here, this base case sluggish growth, it's basically in line with, you know, having growth maybe with a two handle, you know, the 2% and change. That's much lower than we used to have before the crisis, but it's positive growth. And this is a reflection of some good things happening in the economy, such as the housing market recovering, bank lending improving, the labor market improving. But at the same time, this fiscal drag, which is offsetting some of these gains.
So unemployment in this scenario would still remain somewhat far above, shall we say, pre-financial crash levels? I mean, what are your thoughts on where unemployment's going?
Yeah, I mean, I think in that scenario, over the year, you're probably getting in the low sevens.
Okay.
You're not going back to five.
Not going back to five. Do you think we'll ever go back to five anytime soon?
I think it's going to take a number of years until you go back to that level.
Yeah, I would agree. It's... you know, I see a lot of small and medium-sized businesses out in the work that I do, and there is a little bit of hiring going on. I mean, I think there is some optimism. I think certainly the fiscal cliff resolution.
Maybe a flu epidemic would help.
Well, getting rid of the flu, yeah, boy. That's been something,
that's
too.
Very cynical remark. I apologize for that.
Now you, this is interesting to me. You have assigned a 5% probability to what's known as stagflation. And that's where we actually have certain consumer products, like food prices and so on, rise abruptly. So 5% means not necessarily likely, but you actually believe that there's some possibility this could happen.
It could. And, you know, the way this could happen would be if the economy is improving and you're kind of removing the slack in the economy, you start to have some price pressures. And it could be exacerbated. You need some kind of a geopolitical shock, right? So some conflict in the Middle East, for instance, that would lead to at least a short-term rise in prices, and then the whole thing sort of takes a life of its own. That would be the stagflation scenario. And then the problem with that is that you would end up with higher inflation and lower growth. So it's sort of a double whammy.
And let's assume a worst case with regard to the U.S. government. If there were a U.S. government shutdown for more than, say, a day or two, would that increase the probabilities of more negative scenarios?
I mean, clearly, the longer there is a shutdown, the longer the government is not spending on its usual path, the more this slows down the economy. But it, you know, it does take quite a bit of a shutdown. You know, we're not talking days, we're talking weeks to have a more perceptible bite into growth.
Interesting. So do you spend much time analyzing what we call non-traditional investments, going beyond the stock market, bond market, mutual funds, for example, real estate as a general sector?
We look at them typically in terms of how they fit in the portfolio more generally, right? And we think that things like hedge funds or private real estate are good diversifiers because they tend to provide other sources of return than stocks and bonds. And we think that, you know, given enough risk appetite, given enough or lack of liquidity needs for the near term, that these are things that can definitely be considered.
Yeah, it's been interesting what's going on in the housing market here in San Diego. I mean, I actually know some real estate agents who are actually feeling really positive because the supply and demand curve is switching, the supply of homes, because most of the very low-level inventory has been bought because that was the most affordable. The supply of homes is actually very restricted now, and so therefore demand tends to be somewhat competitive.
But Richard,
interesting.
Yeah.
I hear music.
Yeah, we've got to take a short break. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life after this.
Now, It's Your Money and Your Life on Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
We're back with the last segment of It's Your Money and Your Life with Richard Musio and Stephen Friedman. We're going to talk a little bit about housing and emerging markets and other things. Richard, over to you.
Yeah, we don't have much time. And thanks again to Michael Quarantra from UBS to arranging Stephen. Stephen's actually in town presenting to clients and others, and it's always very much appreciated when we can carve some time out to get somebody in here on our show on a Sunday evening. So we were talking about housing here in San Diego, where the supply has dropped dramatically. But let's sort of shift the focus nationally. What are you seeing in the national market on the housing side, Stephen?
I mean, I think you're seeing really good things happening. You know, 2012 was the first year that housing once again was contributing positively to economic growth. 2011 was the first year that it was no longer being a problem for growth. And we think this is a sustainable trend. We think you will see house prices rising nationally. You will see
foreclosures slowing down, hopefully.
Absolutely. We're seeing that already. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's basically a positive trend. It's not going to be a snapback just because lending conditions are still pretty restrictive and that's slowing things down. But ultimately, the general direction is a positive one. And I think it's one of the reasons why ultimately, even with fiscal policy being a drag, the economy is going to be growing at a reasonable pace.
Do you think there's any risk of the tax policy in this country ever limiting the home mortgage deduction before we move on to another topic? I'm just curious what your view on that question is.
I think it is quite a risk, right? Because as part of any sustainable fiscal package, you do have to have some kind of tax reform. And if you look at the positions that really matter, you know, the mortgage deduction is an important one. So, you know, and if that happens, it's probably going to create some pressures for parts of the market, typically, you know, more for the higher end segments. So that could slow down things a little bit. But I think it wouldn't be enough to really throw a monkey wrench into this recovery that we're seeing.
Interesting. Let's shift over to some commodities, grains. I know we've had some very strange weather in the Midwest. Grains have been affected. That would potentially affect food pricing. What are your thoughts on, I want to get to gold later, but just with regard to things like food production and grains?
You know, it's one of these things that is really difficult to predict, because ultimately if you can predict the weather, then you'll be ahead. So I don't claim to have any special insight there. But I mean, it's clearly the case that also you have other factors than weather that matter. And there's the general demand for protein globally, a lot of this coming from Asia. We think that ultimately this does create a bit of a trend for rising food prices, for rising agricultural commodities, generally speaking.
Now, my favorite, gold. I do not understand why gold is trading at the price it's trading. Can you explain that to me?
Well, you know.
Blank stare.
I was wishing we wouldn't go there. Look, we found that gold typically trades in reaction to changes in real interest rates. So interest rates after correcting for inflation. And the fact that interest rates are very low essentially has been a very positive catalyst for gold in the last years. Going forward, if you just take the year ahead, we think gold probably will do fine, just because we have a lot of these fiscal concerns that are still around us, and because monetary policy is going to remain very loose. But I think you want to be tactical with gold at this stage. It's not really something that you want to pile into and just have an allocation for the long term, hoping that this is going to protect you against Armageddon. If you do believe in Armageddon, then probably gold is a maybe a good thing to have. But we do think that it's getting a little bit long in the tooth if you're taking a view of several years ahead.
Speaking of Armageddon, I actually have a bomb shelter underneath the garage in my house in Rancho Santa Fe that was built in the 1950s. I'm afraid to go down there because I think Jimmy Hoffa might be buried down there. But I actually have a bomb shelter. So
hey, there might be a good bottle of wine down there. You better go check it out.
Actually, my wine cellar is my library because I don't drink, so all my books are being cooled to 52 degrees to preserve. But I actually have a bomb shelter. I'm like, that's right. It was the Cold War. Hmm. How about other commodities like non-gold, palladium, or other precious metals? What are you seeing there?
I mean, the precious metals tend to kind of trade together. You have some differences, but I think as long as gold is doing well, the others will do fine as well. And we currently have a positive view for the year, really across the spectrum of precious metals.
Let me ask you about demographics, but I'll preface this. And my guests never know what questions are coming, and you probably didn't expect a question about demographics, but I had the pleasure of having lunch with the head of the California Commission on Aging a few weeks ago, and he pointed out that right now in this country, about one out of every eight people is 60 or over, or are 60 years of age or over, say 12%, but by 2030, it's predicted that one out of every four Americans will be 60 or over, in other words, going from one-eighth to one-quarter. Won't that have a significant impact on markets and what things people buy and what things people invest in and how people behave when our population is, approximately 25% at or near or beyond their working years?
I think demographics are very important over the long term. I mean, they're one of the key drivers that we can predict with some accuracy relative to other things. I'd say two things about demographics. One of them is this lower growth path we're on. This is not all due to the Great Recession and the financial crisis. Part of this was going to happen one way or the other just because of the aging of the population, mm-hmm. and because the workforce is not growing as quickly. But that's one point. In terms of investment behavior, the jury's still out on whether more people retiring, the boomers now starting to retire, whether that's going to lead to a shift in asset allocation. So basically, focusing less on equities, moving mm-hmm. more into bonds. I think that the fact that people sense that bonds are expensive may alleviate that to some extent, but that's certainly something to be watching. You could have, there is a sense that the baby boomers helped the bull markets when they were, in their prime saving years, and now they're moving into their this saving year.
Yeah, so what is it, 10,000 people a day for the next 20 years are going to be turning 65. Is that right, Richard? Something like
that. Oh, that's huge. I mean, yeah. I'm saying, should I invest in senior living housing? It seems like the answer is yes. I know I can't ask you investment questions, but something like that.
There you go.
Something like that. So, Stephen, when you're out here in San Diego, meeting and greeting, what's a typical day like? Who do you meet with? What do you guys talk about? I know without being specific. Just curious.
It's a mixture of having lunch with the groups of clients or dinners with presentations in front of bigger groups, and also just presentations to our branches with talks with advisors, where we're also getting a little bit of a sense of what their clients are concerned about. That also gives us ideas about what to write for the next issues of these.
And when clients express their fears and concerns, I mean, if you had to list one of the biggest what do you hear from the clients? What are they worried about? What's causing them to lose sleep at night?
The deficit is definitely one that is really high up there. We actually have a quarterly survey of investors that was conducted in January, and it was very, very clear that the longer-term debt sustainability was one of the big concerns. Also things like healthcare costs and things like that, sort of retirement-related. The
political environment in Washington is one of them.
That's sort of an ongoing problem.
Yeah. People like but that rate's the highest on your chart there, 78%, 76%, yeah, 67.
Well, yeah, I guess. Well, Stephen made the point earlier in the show that seems to affect people's behavior.
Maybe that's part of the media's fault because they're always beating that drum, too. So.
Oh, who knows? Who knows? So how long are you out here in San Diego? You heading home right after this?
I'm heading back tomorrow.
Okay. Well, There's some bad weather back east. At least you can miss some of it.
Yeah, do you get out here just once a year, or how many times a year do you get out to the...
Last time was 2 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I love the report that we reference that you can get from Michael if you email him. Are you working on another report right now? And if so, can I ask you, what are you working on, or what is it going to be about?
Well, you know, we have a bit of a monthly process for our investment recommendations. So towards the end of the month, you get this report. And then everything else is sort of topical. Mm-hmm. So, you know, right now I'm not doing anything because I'm with you on the show. But next week I got to figure out what I'm going to do.
Well, you folks should definitely get a hold of Vice President Michael Quaranta at UBS in the La Jolla office and go on our website at iymoney.com. You could find his information. Hey, I think we are running out of time there, Richard. So,
gentlemen, thank you very much for wasting a Sunday evening with us. Wasn't a waste at all. We could have gone another hour easy.
We enjoyed it quite a bit. And Richard, thank you. Have a great week. Thank you to Justin Hart on our board operator. Thanks, Dave Sniff, our program director. Thank you to Craig Blank, your con executive. And congrats again to Allegiance for their terrific win. You have a great week, and we'll see you next week.